Good afternoon, and welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Every year, thousands of people are admitted to psychiatric hospitals for treatment that they do not want or understand. The reported experiences range from helpful to horribly traumatic. Almost all report a sense of powerlessness and shame associated with these memories, and many say it was the worst experience of their lives. Psychiatry is the only field of medicine where someone may understand what is being offered and still be denied the right to refuse treatment. When is it appropriate to force someone to admit themselves or be legally committed to a psychiatric facility? Are people struggling with psychosis able to refuse medications? Where is the line drawn between keeping staff and others safe and using restraints and isolation rooms for aggressive patients? Would we really help reduce mass killings by making involuntary psychiatric care easier? And do we even have the correct approach in trying to help one of the most vulnerable population in our communities? Joining me to discuss these and other questions is Dr. Dinah Miller from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. In her new book, Committed, The Battle Over Involuntary Psychiatric Care, Dr. Miller and her co-author, Dr. Annette Hansen, tackled this complex issue by conducting interviews with patients, parents, psychiatrists, law enforcement agencies, and civil rights advocates. Welcome to the show, Dr. Miller. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me, Prentice. It's wonderful to be here.
Okay, I need to remind listeners, this is a call-in show. You can reach us locally by calling 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or if you're outside of Anchorage, anywhere you might be listening, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. If you've never emailed us before, you have to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. I want to remind listeners that if you have a question or a comment for Dr. Miller, please don't wait until the end of the show to give us a call, and we will get your question or your experience on the air. All right. Dr. Miller, I guess I just spent a whole bunch of time reading your book, Committed, and it is a huge task, it seemed, and a huge undertaking that you and Dr. Hansen took on to sort of explore this this really controversial question. Can you give us a little bit about your background and what was sort of the motivation for deciding to write a book of this scope?
Well, thank you for reading it, Prentice, and I will give you some background. So in 2006, Dr. Hansen and I and a third psychiatrist, Stephen Davis, started a blog called Shrink Wrap, and the line on it was by psychiatrists for psychiatrists, but I'll tell you that everybody else came, including people who identified as being patients with mental health issues. And over time, we noted that whenever the topic came to one of involuntary psychiatric care, the topic, the comments, everything got really heated. And people talked about how traumatized they were by being involuntarily treated. I'll tell you that as a psychiatrist, I always assumed that, when people go into a psychiatric hospital, they go in very sick and they come out better. So I assumed that people would be grateful for the care that they received when they were in the depths of a miserable, soul-wrenching depression, or psychotic and unable to realize what was going on. And I obviously have, in training particularly, worked in an inpatient unit, saw people get better, and people got better and they get discharged. So nobody was talking to me about being traumatized. Now, some of my outpatients do sometimes talk about being traumatized, though I'll tell you, mostly people don't like to talk about their time in the hospital. Many say it was a good experience, it was pressing the reset button. But after years of comments and dialogue from people who felt so traumatized, I started to question, well, what is it that we're doing to people that so many are writing in saying this was a bad experience, and so few were writing in saying this was a good experience? And as in most things in our world these days, the topic of involuntary treatment is a polarized issue. You're either for it or against it. So it's hard to find a middle ground, and it's not really, like most topics, it's not a yes or no. It's a nuanced issue. So the blog, I think, led us to start. I started becoming very interested in this topic, and we divided the work that I did, the interviews and the shadowing people and the getting to know everyone, and Dr. Hansen did some of the good bulk of the paper reviews, literature searches, and added that aspect to it.
Well, you did a really good job in the book of, I think, presenting both sides of this argument, both the pros and cons, and talked to a lot of people who were really, really invested in this process. And I think what I came away with was really sort of like what I started with, that this is really, really difficult, and there's not any real easy answers. So hopefully at the end of the show, I'm interested to hear kind of the conclusions that you all came to. But let's start off with, I know, you know, most people have the idea, or many people have in their mind, the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest sort of institutional care that was given back in the 50s and 60s, and then the history of deinstitutionalization and the push to get people out of hospitals and back into community-based supports. Can you talk a little bit about the history of the deinstitutionalization movement and maybe some of the unintended consequences?
Okay, let me start by saying that psychiatric inpatient care today looks almost nothing like what One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest looks like. I am hoping that it is more respectful and kinder, and people aren't, you know, there's this one scene where Jack Nicholson is surrounded by guards who force him onto a table, shove something in his mouth, and give him ECT with no anesthesia. And this is just not what psychiatric care looks like today. But to go to your question on deinstitutionalization, in 1963, the last order that John F. Kennedy signed as president before his assassination was one, the Community Mental Health Act, which called for deinstitutionalizing patients who were being held in state hospitals. And at that time, we had about 500,000 people in this country in state hospitals, many of whom did not need to be there. So we talk about deinstitutionalization these days as a bad thing, but for many people, it really was a good thing. We currently have about 44,000 state hospital beds in this country, down from 500,000, and we have twice the population that we had. So this should give you some idea of quite how short in supply our beds currently are, and how many people were released from the hospital, not all at once, but in phases. And the whole idea was that they would be provided with community care. And the idea was to set up 1,500 community mental health centers. And in fact, about half that number were set up. And the funding wasn't all funneled into community mental health centers. So there are people who really just don't do well in the community. And those people now, they're either in one of the 44,000 state hospital beds, or some of them have ended up in jails, in prisons, and on the streets. Now, certainly, people talk about this as the downside of deinstitutionalization, and it's not all, as you've noted, everything's shades of gray here. It's not all, not everyone who would have been in a state hospital is now in a jail. Some of those people are living comfortably in group homes with their families in their own places. But overall, the promise of what was to be didn't get kept.
All right. Yeah, it seems like there have been both positives and negative consequences to this whole movement. And I know giving people a right to self-determination and to making decisions about their own lives and directing their care is something that's important for empowering people and feeling like they have some control of their lives. But as you mentioned, many of those that fell through the cracks or didn't get the support they needed did end up in being incarcerated in prisons or are members of our homeless community. So it's a complex issue, but I think overall what you're saying, it's a good move, and something that we need to continue to try to improve upon the care of those who are left out.
Right. I think if you're going to take people out of it who've been in institutions for a long period of time and say, well, you can manage in the community with supports and resources, then you need to provide those supports and resources. And our current, the environment has never been for giving that kind of funding to the outpatient community mental health system.
Yeah, it's very preventative focused, and we'll get into that a little bit with some of the problems with the current system. But before we get too deep into the meat of this, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the terminology we're using today. Things like involuntary treatment, forced care, civil commitment, 72-hour hold. What are some of those terms? I think some of them are interchangeable, but can you talk?
Some of them are really confusing.
Right.
So when I started this book and people said to me, well, what are you writing a book about? I would say civil commitment, and they'd look at me and say gay marriage. And my book has nothing to do with gay marriage. So the term involuntary treatment means basically a treatment that's legally mandated that the person does not want. And it gets very sticky, because if you go into an emergency room in the middle of a mental health crisis or in the middle of a diabetic crisis or with chest discomfort, and the doctor says to you, oh, my gosh, this is a crisis, you need to come into the hospital. I mean, if somebody's having chest discomfort, they may look and say, oh, it's not that bad and I have dinner plans, or, you know, my blood sugar's out of control, but I promised my daughter I'd be at her show tonight. Nobody wants to go in the hospital. So some people, especially in mental health, knowing that it can be forced upon you, some people hear you need to go in the hospital. And when I kind of pressed them for, well, what was the hearing like, I discovered that many of the people who thought they were there involuntarily were probably there voluntarily. They were told they had to go in the hospital, and they signed themselves in. In fact, I found one mental health professional who had been hospitalized involuntarily, who told, when I said, well, what was the hearing like, said, oh, I guess I did go involuntarily. So this is sticky, and for the purpose of the book, we drew the line at after you're in the hospital for some period of time, and it depends on the state, there's a hearing with an administrative law judge or with a regular judge. It can be in the hospital, it can be in the court. But at some point, there's a hearing, and if you're kept in the hospital as a result of that hearing, that's a civil commitment. The steps before that all vary by state. So in Alaska, in particular, there's talk of an ex parte order by a judge to get someone into a detention and evaluation treatment center, and there are three of those in Alaska. And from that point, if the judge issues that order, it's called a Title 47. I'm much more familiar with Maryland, where it's called an emergency petition. If the police bring somebody in, or a doctor issues an emergency petition or an EP, or a family member gets a judge to issue an EP, the person's then brought to an emergency room here for an evaluation. If they're admitted to the hospital against their will, there are two physicians who need to sign a certificate, so we call it being admitted on certs or on certificates. And then within 10 days, there's a hearing, and that's a civil commitment hearing.
One of the things it sounds like they've done well is to improve the time frame of these hearings. In earlier years, it sounded like there was often weeks before people were given these hearings, and they didn't have representation, family members weren't included, and oftentimes it sounds like the patients weren't included. Have they improved the timeliness and the ability for people to have advocates or supports in these hearings?
Well, yes, and all of these hearings, people are allowed to have advocates, although I'll tell you that in the book, the person we interviewed was in California, and she insisted there wasn't an advocate in the room, and I spoke with a psychiatrist who said he'd never been to a hearing where there wasn't an advocate in the room. So I don't really know what happened there. None of this was documented in her chart. What I did find is that in Vermont, there was a chapter on civil rights where we followed a woman who was hospitalized the day after her husband murdered her son. She went to an appointment with her psychiatrist. We don't know what happened there, but she was hospitalized against her will, and it was 5.5 weeks till she had a hearing. Now, this is not long ago. I believe this was 2014 or 2015. I spoke with the president of the Vermont Psychiatric Association, who said that it does take a long time there to get to hearings. And my understanding is that in Alaska, that from the time somebody is admitted for an evaluation, what many states call a 72-hour hold for observation, and not every state has that, but that there is a strict 72 hours. If there's not a hearing, the person gets released, whether or not they're dangerous. And so I think Alaska is the shortest time, and Vermont was the longest time that I found. But again, the discussion of involuntary treatment in this country isn't one discussion, it's 50 discussions.
Yeah, that story of that woman, that was remarkable. Her husband and child were killed, and then she went to seek help, and then somehow, and it was unclear, she ended up in the hospital, not being able to grieve, not being able to be around her family and the supports that she went, you know, assumingly to receive from her psychiatrist. And she was just left there for many, many weeks right after this horrific event happened.
Right. We don't know quite all what happened. I believe one of the news stories said the family was in favor of having her in the hospital. And we do know she had access to a phone during that time, because the reason I was able to write about this story is because she was calling a reporter. And so the story was playing out in the newspaper while it was happening. But whatever transpired, the judge agreed with her and let her go. So presumably that would have happened sooner. The other thing I will tell you, that so in Maryland, where people are admitted from an emergency room, about half of the people that the police bring in are let go from the emergency room. Somebody else thought they needed to be in the hospital, but the doctor doesn't think they meet criteria in the ER. Most of the people in any state who come in involuntarily end up signing themselves in. And I can't quite tell you why. I think some people come up to the unit and say, like, oh, maybe this could be helpful. Some say, oh, it'd be a better dynamic if I'm on the same side as the treatment team, and it weren't an adversarial relationship, and there's some truth to that. Some people say, well, I'm going to lose the hearing anyway. And some people come in and they, you know, once they're observed and it's seen that they're willing to get outpatient treatment or whatever the crisis was, because often these are crises of suicide, somebody's had a suicide attempt or somebody has a fairly fast response to medication and treatment. Sometimes people are released before a hearing because they're better. So it doesn't all have a bad outcome.
Right. If you are just tuning into the program, my guest today is Dr. Dinah Miller from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Our topic today is the debate over involuntary psychiatric care, which she tackles in her new book, Committed. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Miller or an experience you'd like to share about today's topic, please don't hesitate to call in or email. As always, you can reach us in three ways. Our local phone number is 550-8433, or you can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so we're thinking there seems to be a big difference in the types of commitments that go on, but we talk about a lot. I think the term that most people are familiar with is danger to self or others. Is that the determination? Is that determination the only circumstance that a person can be forced into treatment? I think of other things such as children, obviously, which is a huge topic. Domestic violence, people are ordered into anger management, or substance abuse. Are there other circumstances which people can be forced to get treatment?
Okay, so I'm going to make a note on the word civil commitment versus when you're talking about people being ordered to substance abuse treatment or to domestic violence, anger management. You know, usually those things are happening because there have been criminal charges pressed. So when we're talking about civil commitment, we're talking about people who've committed no crime, or at least are being charged for no crime. This is not about a criminal legal process. And so you wanted to know, are there other times, what was your question?
Well, there are other arenas where people can be forced into treatment. And yeah, that's a good distinction, because once somebody's committed crimes, then a judge can say, hey, would you like to go to jail, or would you like to do this outpatient program, or go to anger management or something? But are there just where there is no crime, are there other situations where somebody can be forced into treatment?
Okay, so I think we have two questions there. You had originally asked a danger to self or others. And so in order to be involuntarily treated, in every state there's a mechanism to do that for somebody who's both mentally ill and dangerous to themselves or others, usually in a fairly imminent way. So it can't be just like, sometimes I get so mad I'd like to hurt someone. It has to be a little more pressing and a little more sense of there's something believable and somewhat imminent about it. But many states have a separate clause called grave disability, and in fact, Alaska does. The funny thing, though, is it's very hard to define what is dangerous and what is gravely disabled, but presumably somebody, say, who is so disorganized that they can't take their insulin and ends up in an emergency room and their blood sugar is controlled there, but there's this worry that they'll die if they're sent out psychiatrically unstable. And then I guess the brief question of are there other situations? Well, sure, children can be perfectly capable of making decisions, especially adolescents, and their parents are still charged with making their decisions. So we purposely didn't look at involuntary treatment with children because there just isn't one. You don't ask your child, do you want vaccines? Do you want to go to the pediatrician? Do you want to go to school? Or do you want to go to the hospital? So it's only involuntary in treatment if it's the government doing it against the wishes of the parents. And the other issues for people with tuberculosis, you can get them treated against their will. I mean, people are threatened with incarceration if they don't get, because they're a public health hazard. And so that's one example. And I know when I spoke with the head of the Treatment Advocacy Center, Dr. E. Fuller Torrey, he made the point that you could have somebody who has schizophrenia and has got tuberculosis, and they could be forced to get care for their tuberculosis, but not for their psychotic disorder.
That's interesting. All right, so it's mostly, you're talking about danger to self or others, and it sounds like it's mostly always, or quite often, it's a suicidal situation. You mentioned that psychiatry is the only field of medicine that somebody can refuse treatment, but also you bring up in the book points where other people make really unhealthy decisions that put their lives at risk, diabetic folks who don't take care of themselves, heart patients who continue to smoke and eat poorly, and they're allowed to make those decisions.
Well, we let people make all sorts of bad decisions. You're allowed to smoke. You're allowed to ride a motorcycle. You're allowed to eat cookies if you have diabetes or heart disease. In our society, we cherish the right to to drink, to do all sorts of things. I don't think anybody wants their life micromanaged, and we cherish the right to make our own medical decisions. It's a big part of being free.
So where is the where does it lie? I mean, is it with psychiatry? Is it with the history of psychiatry, the stigma of, I mean, why is it different in psychiatric medicine? Someone is deemed to be not able to make those decisions because they're not in their right mind?
Well, I don't think we'd use that terminology, but sometimes, so when somebody gets a mental illness, their thinking often gets clouded. So if you know anybody who's been depressed, just as a friend or an acquaintance, or I believe you have a private practice or as a mental health professional, you know that when somebody's depressed, often they see the world in very dark terms, and they're very pessimistic in a way that may not be their usual thinking. And when somebody has psychosis, and I'll define psychosis for you just briefly, but by that we mean someone who's either hearing voices or seeing things that aren't there, so having hallucinations, or having delusions, meaning that they have ideas, fixed false beliefs that are idiosyncratic. So they're, say, believe that somebody has got cameras planted and is monitoring them when nobody is. If somebody is, obviously, then it's not a delusion. And nowadays, with all the technology, somebody could be watching some places, but usually it has a whole bizarre quality. And the third part of psychosis is sometimes people's thoughts get so disorganized that they can't even really put paragraphs together. You can be so psychotic that you can't, that your speech is jumbled and the meanings of things can't come out in a coherent way. So when someone has psychosis, we assume that, you know, this is a tormenting state. Nobody wants to be in it. It's often a state where the world is a dangerous and awful place and people are trying to harm you. And so we don't feel that people are in that state that can make decisions. And it's not quite true that no one but psychiatric patients can make decisions, as we've mentioned, children, but also patients with dementia or delirium, people who have neurologic disorders that make them unable to make decisions. We have a mechanism for somebody else to make those decisions for them. So the idea is that if somebody is so depressed that they're suicidal, that they may not be rational and they may not be speaking from their own self, for lack of a better term.
It does sound of kind of like we are making decisions that are in their best interest, as we would a child who may not have the ability to make those decisions in a rational, thoughtful way. There's been a word I've been trying to avoid saying because I've never heard of it. It's a nosognosia.
Anosognosia.
Okay.
So I will tell you that I never heard of this term until I had a blog, but apparently it's a word that most mental health professionals seem to know. And what it means is that someone's illness is such that as a feature of the illness, they don't know they're ill. So somebody can have a psychotic disorder, and they believe that someone's out to get them, or someone's trying to harm them, or that there's a whole plot. And things can seem very distressing and angst-ridden, but they don't see it as an illness because it feels so real, which is kind of the point of the definition of psychosis. If you know it's not real, and you know, I think over time people come to see it as real. But you do have this issue of why would you see a psychiatrist because somebody's out to get you? And I don't out to get you is probably the wrong word, but because you're paranoid. And so the idea being that. That there's a neural mechanism behind this. And there's a whole controversy over this. Now, I'll tell you that Dr. Torrey has shared with me many papers that show that there is a neural disorder. The term was used by a neurologist, a Hungarian neurologist named Babinski, if you've ever heard of the Babinski reflex, to describe stroke patients who, after having a stroke, didn't realize they had a deficit. So you'd say to someone, lift your leg, and they'd say, not now, I'm kind of tired, why don't you come back later? Not, I can't lift my leg, oh my gosh, something is wrong. So there is some, it becomes a civil rights issue because if you believe this is biologically determined, then it's a medical issue, just like having a stroke or being impaired because of dementia. But if you believe otherwise, then it's a civil rights issue. And so the term anosognosia gets used to rationalize treating people against their will. And I shouldn't use the word rationalize. I don't want to sound like I don't. You know, clearly there are just times when it seems so clear that this is the right thing to do. And it does, you know, it's a funny thing because it is a polarized issue. So when I started this book, I said, this is going to be the book nobody likes because we're not against involuntary treatment. It seems to make some people who are very sick so much better. But at the same time, we're not really for it as it should be expanded and used, you know, just as the thought of the family members or the doctor. Because our history is that in psychiatry, things have been abused before. So neither of the polarized sides will necessarily like the book, though I have to say everybody said they've liked the book.
It's really well done, but I think it brings to light a whole bunch of really important questions. We're almost at the break, but before we go on break, we're going to go to the phones really quick. We have a call. Betty, you're on line one with Dr. Miller. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
This is Betty. My sister Brenda died from schizophrenia, and there's no treatment up here in Alaska for that kind. At Manila Medical Center, there's none. They have to travel all the way to Anchorage, and that's, what, 1,200 miles?
Yeah.
Even more. So, and there's quite a few people up here in Nana region for that, but there's no treatment here. Well, the next of kin or sibling would take that patient to the hospital, escort them here. There's only one hospital in the Nana region, and there's nine villages around it. But then they have to hop on a plane and go to the hospital. And they don't know what kind of treatment to have for them. If we did have treatment, my sister would still be alive.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't want to cut you off. Did you finish with your question?
Yes. Is there any way that this Nana region in Alaska could get help?
Well, you know, that was one of the things we looked at. We sort of ended up asking in the book or saying is that it's kind of crazy that we have so much discussion about involuntary psychiatric care in this country when there are so many people who want the services we have to offer who can't access them. Voluntary care is an enormous problem. And in researching, before doing the show, I thought I should take a look at the situation in Alaska, and I want to give a shout out to Dr. Josh Sunkiss, who helped me with some answers. And he noted that in some of the regions that are very rural and very far away, that people do have to be brought in by planes, or sometimes in some regions there are police boats that can bring people, but it's very hard to get treatment in regions where there are no psychiatrists, there are no mental health workers, and they're remote and hard to get to. And in order to involuntarily hospitalize someone in Alaska, they have to be brought to one of three detention evaluation training, DET centers, as they're called. And it's a big state with a lot of people, and it's really a problem, both in terms of involuntary care, but accessing voluntary care is an enormous issue. So thank you for bringing that up, and I'm so sorry about your sister.
Thank you, ma'am.
Yeah, thank you, Betty. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about access to care. We're at the halfway point in our show, so we're going to go ahead and take a short break. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. My guest today is Dr. Dinah Miller from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Our topic today is the debate over involuntary psychiatric care, which she and her co-author, Dr. Annette Hansen, tackle in their new book, Committed. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Miller or an experience you'd like to share about today's topic, please don't hesitate to call in or email. Our local phone number is 550-8433, or you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll return to our conversation with Dr. Miller. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Dr. Dinah Miller from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Our topic is the debate over involuntary psychiatric care, which she tackles in her new book, Committed. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Miller and her experience you'd like to share from your own life about today's topic, please don't hesitate to call in or email. Our local phone number is 550-8433, or you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And the last way is to email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Please remember the show repeats tonight at 8, so if you're listening to this on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped broadcast, and we will not be accepting phone calls. All right, before the break, Betty called with a question about rural access to treatment services. And it seems like, I mean, in Alaska, we have that problem on steroids. But in the book, you wrote a great deal about how we approach mental health in our community and how reactionary we seem to be and how much, how much resistance there is to providing outreach services and education for police officers. So can we tackle that a little bit about our approach to mental health and maybe that we sort of have it backwards?
Well, in many ways we do have it backwards. It's hard to access care. And remember, when you're trying to access care, you're usually in a state of distress and nothing about the system is easy. I live in Baltimore. We have two training programs. If you throw a rock in some neighborhoods, you'll hit a psychiatrist. And I've tried to see, like, well, what's it like? I gave a talk at the University of Maryland on access to care. So I tried calling local community mental health centers, and what I discovered is at Johns Hopkins, where I've worked for 15 years, if you call and say, hey, I have a problem and I need to come in to see a therapist, what you're told is, I'm sorry, we're not taking new people right now, but we have a screening day, and come in on the screening day. And if you say, okay, what day is that? You get told it hasn't been scheduled yet. And when it happened 3 months before, 65 people showed up. If you call the clinic nearest my house, you get told, we're sorry, we're not taking new people, but please feel free to call again. And so it's hard to have to first find these phone numbers and figure out who to call. And even if you call people, if you have money and insurance and resources, it can still be hard. A lot of people will ask their internists, and often the internist has somebody they refer to, and sometimes it's very easy. Somebody makes one phone call and finds a psychiatrist they're comfortable with. Are things like outreach, it's not that anybody's against outreach. It's that it's very expensive. You're putting professionals, at least in a clinic, you can be scheduled one patient, then the next patient, then the next patient. For outreach, you're usually talking about more than one person going because people worry about their safety. And because the patients need so much. And you go to one person's house and you hope they're there and you look for them and you wait for them and then you go to another person's house. So this is a very expensive way to deliver care. So I don't know that it's that anybody's against it. I think everybody agrees for the sickest people it's a wonderful idea. It's just it's hard. And there are people who refuse all care, who stay very sick, whose families watch them, just while away their lives and feel so frustrated by it. And so you have to feel sorry for everybody involved here, the family watching their loved one lose their potential and suffer, and the person who's suffering. It's a hard situation, and we don't have great answers as a society.
Yeah, in Alaska, we have, the Medicaid population seems to be at risk quite often. I don't want to generalize, but that's some of the most difficult. It's very, very difficult to get care. There's often a 9-month waiting list for services, for therapy, or to see a psychiatrist. And people, when they call, it really seems to be imperative to get them in at a point where they want help. In contrast to, the expense of community outreach programs, the cost of psychiatric care and the ER and institutionalization and forced commitment also is very, very expensive. So, but it's like prevention versus, you know, reaction. And we seem to be very focused on reactionary care when it comes to psychiatry. Is that accurate?
Well, it is in some ways. So you're right. What we tend to do is leave things until they're a crisis, and then suddenly we're forcing care upon people. So early in the course of an illness, could you imagine feeling horribly, desperately depressed to the point where you're thinking of taking your own life? You finally get up the energy to try to figure out who to call, and you're told, come in 9 months?
Yeah.
Or you're hearing voices, you're disorganized, you're doing funny things or strange things. You're not even going to be able to figure out how to make a phone call, but a family member makes one for you and gets told, bring your relative in 9 months, and if it can't wait that long, there's always the emergency room. I guess the issue of prevention is an issue. You know, you're preventing a crisis, but we don't have any great means at this point. We know risk factors, but we don't know how to prevent mental illness. So the question gets to be, can we prevent suicide? Can we prevent violence? And these are still questions we have left, you know, to some extent unanswered. Certainly their treatment, you know, anybody who has seen patients sees people come in feeling desperate and sees them get better. But this is a...
Yeah, it's a...
You also asked about the police and training, and I followed, in the book I did a chapter on a wonderful crisis intervention training police officer in Rockville or Montgomery County, Maryland, a gentleman named Scott Davis, who was just incredible. But Officer Davis does what's called the Memphis Crisis Intervention or CIT training, and it's a form of teaching police officers to de-escalate a setting, to understand and recognize when there is a mental health issue here. And in Florida, they've used it extensively, but there are now hundreds of CIT programs for police officers around the country. They're not horrendously expensive. They do involve, you know, pulling the police officers from the force for a while to train. But, you know, not every jurisdiction has embraced this. They're not free, obviously, but it has been very helpful in just getting police officers to be aware of the issue of mental illness, to understand what people with mental illness might be doing or why they might be doing. And, you know, if you're hearing voices, you might not necessarily obey an officer who issues a command. And they just become a bit more sensitive to the issues and have training to de-escalate situations.
Yeah, Officer Davis.
Unfortunately, we don't see those positive stories in the news. We see stories of, you know, the horrible, somebody walks up to a store. You know, these stories often have nothing to do with mental illness.
Yeah, the sensational shootings where a disabled person gets shot.
A non-disabled person.
Right.
Somebody gets stopped at a stoplight and gets shot.
Officer Davis mentioned in the book that he has a family member who experiences mental illness and has a lot of compassion for folks. And he talked about the ability of officers as first responders, which they often are to mental health calls, to really be able to manage a situation without it going to tasers and restraints, and how important that education is in keeping people safe and avoiding incarceration of people who have mental illnesses.
Well, he does. He has a great quote in the book. I don't know it offhand, but he started with something like, at 3 a.m., you're their therapist. Nobody's there. Their psychiatrist isn't answering the phone.
Right.
They're calling the police. And I will say, I was shocked at how many people, I think I mentioned it as I went along in the book, how many people mentioned to me family members with mental illness. So Eleanor was a patient that we followed, and Eleanor saw her gynecologist when she had a problem. And the gynecologist said, oh, yes, well, my sister died of suicide. She had bipolar disorder and jumped from the Golden Gate Bridge. And the mental health court judge I followed in Baltimore, Judge Jack Lesser, mentioned that his brother had had a mental health problem, and the person who started the mental health courts in Baltimore Judge Charlotte Cooksey mentioned that her sister had had schizophrenia, and I was just sort of amazed at how many people had relatives with major mental illness. But it does give the people who are working a little bit of perspective and kindness.
It absolutely seemed to.
Everyone doesn't always have.
No, and you hear that over and over again in the book, and I find that to be true in people that I know in different professions. If they have somebody, a family member who's experienced mental illness, they often have much more patience and empathy towards that. I'd like to go. We're getting a lot of phone calls, so we're going to go quickly to the phones. Carol, you're on line one with Dr. Miller. Go ahead. All right. Looks like Carol, are you there? Nope, Carol is not there. Okay, Caroline, can we go to Caroline? You're on line one. Go ahead. Maybe we're having some problems with the phones, perhaps. All right. Yeah, it looks like we're maybe having some tech. Okay.
Yeah.
Carol, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. A question I have is, I have a sister who is bipolar schizoid affective. She hears voices.
Yeah. We're having some phone problems. We just dropped Carol. I'm really sorry, Carol. We'll try to get back to that if she calls back. I do have an email I can read while our phones are getting sorted out. I was involuntarily committed while visiting New York State on a Friday, and the supervising psychiatrist wasn't in until Monday. I was sleep deprived and by Monday was back on track. The psychiatrist was not going to discharge me despite the staff recommending to do so, stating she was not going to risk her license. Additionally, the only out was to take medication. Being from Alaska, I was treated like I was from a different planet. I am a 64-year-old healthcare professional of 30 years. All I needed was a good night's sleep. The doctor on the show that you acts like everyone who is committed is deservedly so. That was the worst 9-day experience nightmare of my life.
Well, thank you for writing in, and I'm so sorry you've had this experience. I don't think we take the, in the book, we don't take the idea that everybody who is committed, I mean, sometimes there's just miscommunications. Especially in the day of social media, sometimes a teenager posts something that can be read as suicidal.
Right.
You know, and sometimes there's just a kind of miscommunication, and there just needs to be a little time to sort it out. And unfortunately, over a weekend is often not the best time. But I want to point out your comment about the doctor not wanting to lose their license, because you have conflicting issues when you talk about involuntary care. You have the fact that we believe in America that people should have the right to make their own health care decisions. We have the patient who may or may not want to be in the hospital. We have the family who hates watching a family member. It's just heart-wrenching to watch a family member, you know, be sick and not do well. And then we have the doctor who wants to do what's ethically and medically right, who doesn't want to be sued for malpractice, who doesn't want to see somebody die unnecessarily, who has to figure out, you know, basically have a crystal ball to figure out what will happen sometimes. And certainly the wrong calls are very highly publicized.
Right.
And so there are all sorts of, and then we have the insurance company who doesn't want to pay for anything. So you can have a case where everybody agrees the patient needs to be in the hospital, and the insurance company won't pay for it. So that's a sort of aside that doesn't even get mentioned.
Yeah, it's a complex issue, and I think in your book you don't make the argument that all involuntary or forced commitment is necessary or necessarily handled in the right way. There are mix-ups. There are, you know, mistakes made, and you know, sometimes it is a better safe than sorry sort of approach. I think we have Carol back. We'll give the phones another shot. So Carol, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry for the mix-up there. Yes, Dr. Miller, I have a question. My sister is a schizophrenic and bipolar and both, and she cycles in and out of the local psychiatric institute, and they keep her for the, usually they take her into the hospital, ER, psych ER, for observation, and then they take her to the local API, and they keep her for the duration of 72 hours, which is how long they can keep someone against their will, as I understand it. And usually at the end of it, they decide she's not a threat to herself or others, so they don't keep her longer. One time recently, they did keep her for 30 days, at the end of which they let her go. And as soon as she gets back out, she's going into the same behavioral mode, and she gets picked up again for disorderly conduct or something and is taken back in. It's a constant repeat process. She doesn't want to take a medication, although she used to take it 20 years ago. She took it religiously for a very long period of time, held a job for 5 years, got a little retirement, et cetera. But now she's totally against it, and she's like 70 years old. We've been advised that perhaps we should not try to help her financially. She gets SSI, not enough to live on. Really, but we've been advised that we should stand back and take the do tough love approach and not pay for her way or help her to get along. And that's the question I have. Should we exercise tough love with her or what?
So, I might not be the right person to ask this just because I'm not a fan of tough love. And you're talking about somebody with an illness who... often, but the thought I immediately go to when you hear a story like this, because it is a frustrating, awful story for the family. Somebody who takes their medicines and gets well, who refuses to take the medicines, and you know, I'm somewhat sympathetic to people refusing to take medicine sometimes because they have side effects and they don't feel well. But isn't it horrible to watch somebody who gets better, who could function, who just refuses to, and there's so little that can be done? One of the things that often gets done is outpatient commitment, but that doesn't get done very much in many states.
Right.
Alaska does have a provision for it, but logistically it just can't be done. Dr. Sunkist mentioned to me that the difficulties in actually putting that through. But the other thing you wonder about in that story is, are you being told to not give her resources because she's using it for drugs or alcohol? Because that
no.
is the so there's no drugs or alcohol involved.
No,
nothing. So I don't really know quite if the idea is maybe if you don't give her any money or don't help her survive, that maybe she will then feel desperate and take the medicines and get better herself. But
that's the issue. That's the point they're saying. She has to get up against the wall and get desperate before she will change. But
and at 70, I don't know if that's going to happen or not. Or at any age, if you really just don't think something's wrong with you, then taking medicines that make you feel badly, you know, and then you always get into, could something better be done with them? Could she find a medicine that doesn't make her feel badly? Or why isn't she taking the medicine? But I share your frustration. It's just, you know, there are stories where you think maybe somebody would be better in some type of, hospital or supervised living situation, and how painful it is for the family to watch this. And would she have a better life if she was, you know, and often there's a way of giving antipsychotic medications through an injection that lasts for several weeks. Would that be helpful to her? But she does have to allow for that unless there's a court order in place. And I'm sorry you're going through this.
All right, Carol.
I appreciate you talking to me. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Carol. I would say get with, there has to be, or there probably is, a treatment team of folks who have been working with her and really come together with a plan to get some supports around. But I agree, like, tough love at this point, if there's not drugs and alcohol, seems to be kind of a tough, punitive approach. I want to read an email.
Well, I just say that tough love, even if there are drugs and alcohol, the problem is that, you know, I mean, I know there's a very strong tough love advocacy, but I worry that people, you know, the result of not giving someone support sometimes is that they end up dead.
Yeah.
And that's just never a good thing for everyone to have to live with.
At the beginning of the show, we talked, Dr. Miller, this is an email. At the start of the program, Dr. Miller talked about being told by some people who had been involuntarily committed that they had been traumatized after being treated involuntarily, but this hasn't been discussed since. The question is, in writing your book, what were your findings about why people felt traumatized? What was the hardest part of that?
Oh, this is such a great question, and I will tell you that the entire book is about people feeling traumatized, particularly Eleanor, the woman we traced through. And that's the downside, is that you feel like you're doing something to get someone help who doesn't realize they need it, and then they come out so much better, but so traumatized. And so in Eleanor's story in the book, the care she describes is at moments, you know, you hear the story from her side only. And sometimes people don't realize how angry or scary they come off as being when they're sick. They minimize it because I think there's sort of a natural defense mechanism to not want to look at yourself that sick or that scary. And so sometimes people are put in these awful situations of being in seclusion or in restraints, which is just absolutely horrible, but, you know, at the same time, there's the balance of keeping the other patients and the staff safe. And sometimes people in agitated states do hurt people. So the question gets to be, well, could you have minimized seclusion if you had somebody on a one-on-one watching them? Are there the resources to do this? So some of the traumatization issue, which we heard a lot about, and which I think the gentleman who wrote in saying he'd been hospitalized in New York mentioned.
Yeah.
Some of it we found was really about care that was just not as careful as it could have been, not as considerate and thoughtful as it could have been. Sometimes we found people were just very sensitive to the things that were said. And some of the stories I heard were people who were traumatized when everything went well. So one woman who told me a story of she was threatening, she made the comment that she might want to kill herself because she was so upset about discovering she was pregnant with twins. And her husband was so beside himself that he asked his psychiatrist what to do. They got both families. They had an ambulance bring her to the hospital rather than a police officer. But somewhere in there, she started to realize that if she said the wrong thing, she would be kept against her will. And she felt very traumatized by this. She was released and told she agreed to go to some therapy sessions. Some of it was people just seemed very sensitive to the words used with them, and other times it was just very insensitive care.
Yep. I feel like we're just getting rolling here, Dr. Miller, but we are in our last minute of the show, so I appreciate you taking the time to join me, and I'm sorry to have to let you go so soon, but thanks a lot. I appreciate it. All right, next week on Line One, Dr. Woodard returns to take a look at how socioeconomic issues and adverse childhood experiences impact mental health, or impact physical health. So why not tune in and learn more? That's Monday, August 14th at 2 p.m., repeating at 8 on FM 91.1. Eric Bork was our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. For all of us at Line One, thanks for taking the time to join us today. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.